Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Scales of Truth. Today, I'm going to go back to a topic that is just so fertile. The entire, I don't mean this as a pun, but the entire bullshit, fertilizer, that is known as Big Pharma. So I had said during one of my last episodes, I was going to cover an article that is by Raw Egg Nationalist. I just see sources and the articles. I don't really care about the sources. And I eventually, you know, like I was searching for, okay, I need to find this again. Can I find it? Even on Brave Search. And of course, it's just buried by a bunch of PR on Big Pharma. I'm putting in very specific search terms relating to the article name. And of course, it doesn't come up. A bunch of PR press releases and stories come up. But then I find out that Raw Egg Nationalist is a conspiracy theorist, far right. So you look, and that's not really the case. You just stick that label on it so you know, watch the necklace as it goes back and forth. So the article that I'm talking about, but it does refer to another one. I don't know if I'm going to go to this one. I might a little bit. It's called Raising the Bar, It's Time to Overhaul How the FDA Licenses Drugs. Now, I found the study that he is commenting on a little bit here. So we'll go over that specifically and then also cover a few related topics. And but I first want to give that bullet that is at the top of the article. Between 2013 and 2022, almost 73% of all drugs approved by the FDA didn't meet the agency's very own four foundational standards. In the three approved trials, I'm sorry, hold on a second. That's talking about, we might go into this. Raw Egg Nationalist talks about how he wrote about Brexpiprazole that had just been approved, making it the first licensed antipsychotic drug for dementia sufferers. And so we might talk about this and might a little bit, but I'll highlight it first and then we'll get to the larger pattern. He says that it's not that the drug doesn't work, but it doesn't, but also the FDA, that's not the biggest point, obviously. It doesn't work. The FDA knew it didn't work. In the three pre-approved trials, the drug brought just a 5.3 improvement for users on a 174-point scale. 17 points is a minimum for an improvement to be considered clinically significant. And also, the drug increased the user's risk of death fourfold. So with that, I found some associate. We'll probably get back to that, maybe. But I saw some terminology that I thought was interesting that I'm wondering whether or not I'm going to, kind of anticipate where they're going with this. Well, how the hell did it get approved then? Now, this guy's going to talk about, and I'm going to refer to the other article that explains it more fully, what's going on with the, fact of, what do you mean 73% don't hit the FDA's foundational pillars? But I happen to see some language. Let me see if I can find it. Yeah, that this drug is approved for a drug. I mean, it's a toxin, just like basically all of them. But let me find this. It's approved for adjunctive treatment. What does adjunctive treatment mean? Adjunctive treatment, by its definition in the dictionary, means not basic nor primary, adjunctive therapy. So let me see if I can find that article again real quick. Adjunctive brexpiprazole in patients with unresolved symptoms of depression on antidepressant treatment. So you've got dementia, you've got antidepression, and now you're going, and again, this is a perfect potential Pfizer circle of hell, because people can say, when you take this, it can increase your likelihood of depression. And then you go, well, I mean, you could take brexpiprazole since you're taking antidepressants. And that's adjunctive. So it's going to be interesting to see if they could say something about a lower standard, because, well, it's not the antidepressant treatment. It's as a reaction to the antidepressive treatment. Yeah, but you're still are supposed to be addressing the specific concern that it's supposed to be, you know, good to treat. So it still should have to be statistically significant. So we'll go over an article. Let's see here. We might go over Raw Egg Nationalist, but there's an article that is going to cover this. We might cover this one, FDA under fire, data discrepancies uncovered in AstraZeneca approval trials, just as a pattern recognition and pattern pile-on. Here's another one, integrity concerns in Tyka Graylor trials, not sure how you say that, challenge clinical confidence. We might do that, but this is the underlying one that Raw Egg Nationalist is talking about at the top of his article. Oh, that's not it. Give me a second. Off of brownstoneinstitute.org, it is called, and it might be just a, it might possibly be just a transcript from a podcast. FDA exposed hundreds of drugs approved without proof that they work. January 27th, 2025. 6 minutes. And it is an article. It looks like it's just that it has a listen to this article option. Let's see, FDA approved and ineffective. This is the one that was underlying, I believe, about... No, it's going to be a supplementary one about the same idea. Maybe not a foundation, but certainly FDA approved, even though they shouldn't have approved it, because it was not a showing of effectiveness. So we'll go over that one. Let me decide which one to kind of go through first. Let's just really highlight this Raw Egg Nationalist. I'm thinking, but I'm not sure, is the 5.3 improvement for users on 174-point scale. He references it's supposed to be 17 points minimum for an improvement to be considered clinically significant. So I don't know if that's based on the study population. That's what you would normally think. But the point there is he might be putting it in plain language and doesn't want to say statistically significant. And just wants to say, hey, long story short, they're one-third of the way to what's the minimum for significant. And it does say clinically significant, so they are probably talking about statistically significant. There was not enough of a change, given the population you had, to take it out of the probability of chance, the whole usual idea of whether or not we're far enough removed from your placebo or your control group for us to go, now this is... We're going to consider this as a population to be beyond the, you know, we're going to make the decision that this difference makes it beyond what we would expect chance to ever give, so we can call it significant. So he says, so no significant improvement, but a 4 times greater risk of death. But then he says, that's not the only one. In every previous trial of antipsychotics for dementia sufferers that took place. The fact of non-clinical significance. And the thing was that those drugs weren't approved, but brexpiprazole/Rexulti was. So we're going to go into more of these. It's going to create the pattern. But this is where he's talking about the article I'm going to go to. We can still get an idea of how such an obviously nonsensical approval could take place. And it has to do with falling standards at the regulator and growing corporate influence over it. Because he said, well, the FDA hasn't commented on how this could be, given that it didn't get to clinical significance. Well, he says that the 21st Century Cures Act in 2016 was... Well, it was supposed to allow drugs to reach the market quicker, but that affected rigor and certainty. And a far greater proportion of drugs are now approved with just a single study than ever before. You know, usually you would say you publish a study and then somebody else has to peer review and probably even duplicate the results, right? And then they say a significant proportion, I've talked about this in different articles, A significant, I'm sorry, different episodes. A significant proportion of drug trials are not disclosed on the FDA's website, as they should be. Therefore, when we look, we don't see all the failed drug trials. All the drug trials that were started that didn't get the results that they wanted, but you could at least kind of aggregate and compile to understand, well, I mean, yeah, you supposedly attain statistical significance, but it was your fourth attempt. So what did you do in the first three? And they're saying it's, I'm thinking they're saying that it's not even that the details aren't there, but they're not listed. It says are not disclosed on the FDA's website, which is something we've talked about before. And what you do is you, as drug companies, you know, are trying to get public pressure, they fund or coordinate closely with patient advocacy groups, right? And the patient just knows they're looking for something. They may not have the the statistical and academic rigor, and they hear the sales pitch. And so then the patient groups can go, we want this drug. It's supposed to cure what I have. Doesn't matter if it does. They've heard the sales pitch. And so these patient advocacy groups, for one, for instance, Otsuka, is the funds one of, or rather multiple patient advocacy groups for brexpiprazole. said it again. I just like to say words, even though I could have said Rexulti. Otsuka, one of two manufacturers of the drugs, funds multiple patient advocacy groups. One of the two manufacturers of the drug, brexpiprazole. Yeah. So, here you go. And he does mention the investigative report. Maybe I'll just use his highlighted instead of going to the investigative report from the lever. So when I said I had one from the lever, let me find that again. Well, shoot, there it is. FDA approved and ineffective. June 5th, 2025. I just accidentally went back one page. Just a second. Give me just a moment. I went back a page, I think. So give me just a moment. I kind of let my finger slide. Lever, lever, lever. FDA approved and ineffective. June 5th, 2025, under the lever. Federal regulators have authorized hundreds of drugs without evidence they work, and many are dangerous. So this raw egg nationalist article, to the extent it summarizes, will let it. 73% of all drugs approved by the FDA didn't meet the agency's very own four foundational standards, which are, by the agency's own admission, the bare minimum for a drug to be considered fit for approval. So again, their own requirements, 73 didn't hit the four foundational standards, which are supposed to be minimum, the four. But worse, 55 of those 429 drugs approved over that period, 2013 to 22, met only one of the four foundational standards. And 39 met none of them, especially for cancer. So you can imagine a great patient advocacy group funded by who the hell knows. Only 2.4% of 123 cancer drugs approved between 2013 and 2022 met all four of the foundational standards. Only 2.4. 29 drugs are almost one quarter, 23% of the 123 cancer drugs approved met none of the foundational standards. A study carried out over 2 years by four experts, three physicians, and a postdoc fellow at Harvard. Sifting through government reports, internal FDA documents, congressional testimony, court records, interviews with more than 100 researchers, legal scholars, current and former federal officials, patients and their families, then vetted by a 14, those expert findings were then vetted by a 14-member advisory committee, including an FDA insider and FDA advisor. So what they're saying there is, you know, we talked to a lot of people, we have experts, and then even after we compiled and came to our conclusions, then we brought it in front of 14 other people. Says Diana Zuckerman, founder and president of the nonprofit National Center for Health Research, who sat on that 14-member advisory committee for this study. She said, "I've been discouraged about the FDA before, but the last few years have been the worst. The scientific bar is often so low, it would be impossible to lower it much further." And I guarantee the last few years, what happened in the last few years? We're in 2025 now. She's saying the last few years. When did science become just a slogan? And at the most in our history, and just a slogan backed by social pressure instead of a standard? 2020, 2021, 2022. And you go, oh, well, wait a second. Pfizer can get funded for not just research, but development all the way through, making their R&D be $0. And then we also pay them for every single treatment around the globe. And then they don't get in trouble because we were kind of, you know, holding their hands when they developed the thing, even though, go back and listen to my old episodes. I talk about this one a lot. I kind of thought it was October 22nd of 2020. But anyway, the FDA all-day meeting where they had slides that talked about 2 years before, 2 years, 2 months before it was released as a general vaccine, all the problems with the vaccine, and they state them, but only quickly on slides and show them visibly all the way up to pericarditis and myocarditis, swelling of the heart and swelling of the membrane around the heart. And all of the other worst case ones, they were on the slides. It's just that if you were kind of watching for 8 hours, the speakers did not highlight them and let a total of about four slides, it was three or four, show for only about 3.5 to 4 seconds total without mentioning any of them verbally or going, "You'll notice here," or summarizing it in any way. So, thus, the last few years, I'll quote again this, "I've been discouraged about the FDA before, but the last few years have been the worst." So there you go, 2022 or so, mid-ish 2022. "Scientific bar often so low it would be impossible to lower it much further." Yeah, and this is totally true. The report looks all the way back to the AIDS epidemic, which I've told you about. I've told you about before. I've told you that was where, even among the gay community in New York, where they were connected, they realized, you know, out in Oklahoma, they didn't realize it. They didn't have a network as much, or, you know, other rural states. I'm not picking on Oklahoma. And, you know, those folks informed each other of, no, it's a toxicity of the drug itself. It's not AIDS. But at the time, even that small amount of dollars, it would seem quaint now. But the treatment we were talking was $1,000 to $2,000 a month, and that really raised eyebrows. But yet it was approved preemptively, even though it was also caused your immune system to be damaged by its very definition of how it worked. Highlight, if you've heard my episode, just bear with me. It destroys cells when they split. That's the mechanism. Well, your immune system, when you have something coming into the body, it tries to multiply, you know, your antibodies and other immune cells. So therefore, the effectiveness, or rather, the cells and tissues that this toxicity is disproportionately the worst on, are those
that undergo multiplication. Well, your immune system undergoes multiplication at the most important time when it's trying to fight something, and AZT is what it was called at the time until they hit its name three or five times, exactly killed your immune system along with your hair and everything else, like your cancer treatment. So they said, hey, yeah, probably AIDS epidemic is the key turning point for drug safety. And I'll tell you again who's behind it, Fauci. Take it preemptively. I don't even feel bad yet. Take it. All of a sudden, at those early heavy doses, you felt bad pretty soon. Oh, now you've got full onset AIDS. I do, absolutely. Can't you see that your immune system? Can't you see? And the bluff worked. So, I said tens of thousands more were living with the disease. Activists partnered with drug companies to pressure the FDA to loosen regulatory standards. To do so, they argued to be the compassionate choice. And there was something like, around that time, because I'm old enough to remember this, even though I was fairly young, and then once I read Why We Will Never Win the War on AIDS, it kind of categorized it back together. I didn't have a lot of, suspicion at the time. I was a little too young for that. But at somewhere around there is when they said, we don't have time to continue the study. And so that became their excuse to not continue study for safety. And this might be where this article goes. They said, so a longer-term safety study is not important enough because we got to get this incredible miracle treatment to both sides. These poor control group people aren't getting this incredible miracle drug. And so they shut down the duration of the safety study. And when the whole purpose of the safety study is to, yeah, but these guys have AIDS, so we can't worry about whether or not we're giving them a deadly treatment. We're going to assume it's not deadly, which it might show if you kept the study longer. It was very circular, but that's science even in the late 80s and early 90s once fucking Fauci got his fucking demonic face into it. So there you go. Which, so they're talking about, a new accelerated pathway that allowed drug makers to bypass the onerous requirements. So we're going to do history, and we are going to touch on those couple of articles that talk about, this doesn't where they've been caught recently. I do think I want to do that. So they go, why don't we bypass, multiple clinical trials? And that could be 7 to 12 years. Why don't we just allow them to provide surrogate outcomes, is what they called it, more limited data that suggested rather than showed desired improvements for patients. That's what I'm talking about. Oh, no. It doesn't show that it does it, but it suggests it might. We should stop it now. We should stop the safety study now. There's no time. I mean, remember, emergencies take away logic. We don't have time for logic and process. This is an emergency. And that's what happened during the AIDS crisis, and then it turns into the process. Just like how you'll hear somebody talking about, the United States, and they've been in emergency mode for however many decades, and that allows a bunch of things that otherwise would not be allowed. I'm telling you that based on this, in essence, they've been in emergency mode since the AIDS crisis. Oh, no. We don't have time for these onerous multiple clinical trials and all these years. We just don't have time for that. It's an emergency. These drugs are so life-saving that if they just indicate they might, then we need to use them. Well, doesn't that take away the whole idea of whether or not they're actually effective for sure and whether they're safe for sure? So again, then instead, drug makers were allowed to provide a surrogate outcomes, more limited data that suggested rather than showed desired improvements for patients, with the expectation that more substantive data would be provided once a drug was on the market and use. But when we do that, we do all these, there's a word for it, I'm just blanking on it. It's the word that means looking back. But they almost never take any drugs off the market for it. I mean, and at that point, the press ship is, you know, off and going, and all the advertisements are there, and you get all these patients being psychologically tricked into this is a thing that's going to help them. You're going to tell me 6 months later, 2 months late, 2 years later, and tell those people don't take it? By that time, and this is exactly how, well, I guess these treatments are just, you know, part of you getting the disease. Yeah, it's really bad. And there they go. Of course, AZT, they talk about it in this article too. I actually had not looked at that, but I knew that that AZT study was bullshit. And it's going to say this, but I'm going to say it off the top of my head just to show off. I said it many podcasts. It was a cancer drug that was so toxic, they left it on the shelf. The general mechanism was the same idea, but, and I usually can think of the name of the mechanism, but in essence, when the RNA or DNA are splitting, it kills it at the time it splits. It breaks a chain, therefore the thing dies. Therefore, why it's related to, and you know, to things that, which is what cancer treatment drugs do too. It just makes better sense there, because cancer treatment is about the body multiplying cells too much. But I said, even with this, you know, when you're at the end of your rope, and yes, it's going to be very toxic, but we're at our last battles now. We have to try to kill the cancer before the cancer kills us, and hopefully we survive the cancer treatment. But it was so toxic, it was sitting on the shelf, and then somebody decided to go, what if we used it for AIDS? And then it just became the AIDS drug. So that's my background to show off-ish, or just to give background. Let's see what they say. Burroughs Wellcome demonstrated that their drug increased specific kinds of immune cells in the body. So it was expected the drug would help fight AIDS. You know how it increased specific immune cells? Because you put a toxin in the system. Your body's going to try to fight the toxin, you daft idiots. So it was expected the drug would help fight AIDS when AZT hit the market. However, more detailed clinical data showed the drug had little to no effect after an early period of enhanced immune function. Again, you have a general response. We've talked about this before. I'm not saying this is the case in this deal, but I've seen them argue this. I've talked about that press release where they go, hey, Pfizer's so happy, we have a general immune response. You put any toxicity into the body, you're going to get a general immune response. That has nothing to do with the targeted immune response. So, yeah, had little or no effect after an early period of enhanced immune function. Users sickened and died of AIDS as surely as if they'd taken no medication at all. And instead, even an accelerated group, which they're not going into that whole rabbit hole here, or say an accelerated rate. So he goes, you know, what are we going to do? And I guess, oh, its own standards. They don't talk about the standards. I'm going to go to the other article and talk about those standards just because I'm interested, and I think it'd be good content. So as to this article, there's actually, it's two parts on the lever, and the first one is the deadly secrets behind, pardon me, got scratched in my throat, breakthrough, quote-unquote, Alzheimer's drugs. Give me just a second. I'm going to look quickly look through here, and if this lists the four foundational pillars, which is what I want to get to first. Okay, so the lever was behind the paywall after a little period of time, and it might be that you can just use a free user. It actually looked like that. I'm just not doing that now. So I'm going instead to another article that covers that study, and it is on childrenshealthdefense.org, not because I went there, but because I searched. And this one's called, also June 5th, FDA approved hundreds of drugs with no evidence they work. Now, quickly, what I want to do is go to those pillars, and those pillars that they're not meeting are four criteria according to FDA standards: control group, replication, blinding, and clinical endpoint. And I'm going to define each of these. Control group: patients taking the drug were compared to a control group
that was given a placebo or a comparator drug. I mentioned this the other day where I thought that was lame for a comparator drug because all the drugs are generally toxic. So to compare them to each other is as though you're comparing the health of, you know, people in the midst of the Flint water crisis before you understand there's a Flint water crisis, and you're comparing all the people who drink a lot of tap water. It's a bad comp. You need to compare it to the Michigan City nearest, 15 miles away that is otherwise, approximately, similar. So, but it is on the foundation. I just think that that's garbage. But it says, given a placebo or a comparator drug. I'd be interested how many people do the comparator drug instead. It replication, because that's the sneaking toxicity, You know that something is, you're a little worried it might be more toxic, but you pick something that you know has a lot of admitted side effects and you compare yours to it. And then your placebo doesn't even have to compare it to just healthy individuals not taking the drug. Replication, at least two, quote, well-controlled, end quote, trials showed the drug was effective. All right, so that's not even safety. Safe and effective as well. There just might be shortening it, but certainly at least effective. Blinding. Subjects in the studies and the doctors who care for them don't know which patients are on the drug and which are in the control group. So when you go back to the beginning where it was some percentage hit none of... I mean, isn't that the most basic 10th grade science? What is science? What is a scientific study? How do we ensure that, you don't get even psychological cues from the doctors that are true or false, where somehow, because they know, then their patients pick up on it directly or indirectly that they're on the placebo, so they don't believe in the placebo enough. And so there is some psychological idea, the whole idea of placebo. And so now they know they're on placebo, the placebo effect of thinking, hey, I think I'm taking the drug is reversed, because you get some kind of indicator, because it's not double blind, that you're actually not on the drug itself. So again, then control group, replication, blinding. I'll repeat that. Subjects in the studies and the doctors who cared for them don't know which patients are on the drug and which are on the control group. Subjects and the doctors who cared for them. Clinical endpoint. This is an important one. I'm going to see if I can grasp it along with you as I read it. The studies measured the drug's effect on patient survival or function rather than a surrogate measure. And so this is going to be, I've told you a lot, what they'll say is the surrogate measure has been associated with drug A has shown a statistical effect on symptom A, which has been associated with lower cardiovascular risk. So instead of getting to yes, but was there lower cardiovascular risk? They get to study the surrogate measure. So again, this is important, and this is how they screw us and start their non-logic. Clinical endpoint. The studies measured the drug's effect on patient survival or function rather than a surrogate measure. Now, even with those four foundational pillars, the control group, replication, blinding, and clinical endpoint, it doesn't guarantee, quote, sound scientific evidence, according to the authors. But it does make up at least the minimum criteria as to whether they have provided substantial evidence. So this is a degree short of sound.
Like, have they provided substantial evidence to support their claims? And yet, only 28% of the drugs approved over the 10 years met the four criteria. 72% are out. Only 29% met three criteria. And 9% didn't meet any of them. So I want you to think about that. 9%, almost 1 out of 10 drugs, did not use a control group or not properly. They weren't given a placebo or a comparator drug to compare to. So it was, they somehow attained, quote, substantial evidence without that. You know, even though that's the definition of substantial evidence is all four of them, the FDA approved them anyway. 9% didn't meet any of them. It means that in some of them, there were not at least two well-controlled trials showing the drug was effective. And that could be where you say 29% met three criteria. I would bet that they have one study and they do not have a second one. That's probably your 29% that met three. Or they don't actually measure the drug's effect on patient survival or function. They use that surrogate measure like such and such, which has been associated with a lower cardiovascular risk. This drug has been shown to affect. And it could be because the 9% didn't meet any of them. Go back to that. There was only one trial. Or there was only one well-controlled trial, or there was no well-controlled trials, or those trials didn't show the drug was effective. I mean, whatever you can do to neutralize this definition. Or, since 9% didn't meet any of them, I should say, there's no control group, there's no replication, either the subjects or the doctors or both knew who was on the drug and who were in the control group. 1 out of 10? Like, clinical endpoint, at least about 1 out of 10, besides not having a proper control group, besides not blinding so people don't know whether they're control group or not, besides not having replication and having at best one trial or one well-controlled trial, they don't have two. They don't have at least two. And besides those three things, then, the studies did not measure the drug's effect on patient survival or function rather than a surrogate measure. 1 out of 10. And so this is what we're talking about. That doesn't mean these drugs don't work, but it does mean the FDA approved them without knowing whether or not they are more likely to help patients than hurt them. And again, we talked about drugs for cancer were a huge percent, whatever we said earlier. See, there you go. Is it that it really helped your cancer, or is it a substitute? Like, well, I mean, well, the tumor shrunk for a while, rather than clinical outcomes such as reduced mortality or decreased symptoms. I know you don't feel it yet, but don't you worry. I'm the cancer version of Dr. Fauci. I've seen the reading that you wouldn't know otherwise. And I know you still feel like shit. And I know you still have cancer, but the tumor shrunk. Okay, but for how long? And did it reduce mortality, or did just as many people die of cancer? quote from the article. Experts say the FDA should have no illusions regarding the unreliability of such surrogate outcomes, especially since these outcomes fail to take into account the harms a drug may cause, such as liver failure and anemia. And what was my podcast the other day on? Liver failure, you know, anemia and the like. So I'm going to go to that link real quick and see if there's anything particular I want to add off of that. Give me a moment. I don't know, I'll go into it, I'll think about highlighting this, but the link to surrogate is not always very effective, the unreliability of such surrogate outcomes. links to in a web archive org, because it's probably gone otherwise, but maybe that's just where they found them. BMJ, which for some reason I'm forgetting at the top, maybe British Medical Journal, but regardless, 2021 study, should regulatory authorities approve drugs based on surrogate endpoints? The aducanumab controversy is the latest example of surrogate endpoints failing to predict clinically important outcomes. Yet, as Gene Lenzer and Shannon Brownlee report, who I believe might have been the people on the Lever article, they increasingly provide the basis for drug approvals. So let me see if there's anything I want to highlight here before getting back to the main article, just a moment. Yeah, the most obvious thing to highlight is just this. In November 2020, not one of the U.S. FDA administrations, I'm sorry, FDA's 11-member advisory committee voted to approve Biogen's aducanumab for the treatment of Alzheimer's. When FDA administrators nevertheless went ahead with the approval on 7 June 2021, three members of the committee quit in protest, sparking a national outcry. Sure, I've mentioned that type of thing in passing, maybe even potentially that very thing. Let me look at this article if there's anything otherwise that would have me go down this thread as opposed back to the other article. Give me a moment. Yeah, this is a good example of just goes to the heart of the disaster that is the FDA and certainly the surrogate outcomes. But when you, if once you hear this, it's going to be hard for it to go away. Like, that's not even the thing. That's just a related thing. When you hear the commercials about the drugs, it's just the related thing. So their example off of this article off of Web Archive is take abnormal heart rhythms. While such rhythms can be deadly, they are nonetheless a surrogate outcome. Myocardial infarction and death are the important patient endpoints. Did you have a heart attack? Did you die? For more than a decade, the American Heart Association recommended lidocaine. Oh, wow, I remember that now. As standard treatment for patients with acute chest pain, based on the drug's remarkable ability to stop potentially deadly arrhythmias. The guidelines were subsequently withdrawn after a 1995 federally funded clinical trial found that patients treated with oral drugs related to lidocaine were 3.6 times more likely to die than those given placebo. Perfect example. This is worthy of another example because it goes to just the underlying problems of the FDA, which is the topic of this and the foundational pillars. I know this is to the one. It's about whether or not you're using surrogate outcomes instead of regular out, you know, the clinically important outcomes. Similarly, I'm going to have a hard time with this one. I'm going to try it. Bevacizumab, probably not quite emphasized right. Bevacizumab was granted accelerated approval in 2011 for metastatic breast cancer based on improved, quote, progression-free survival, which is non-meaning. It's supposed to mean make you think it means more than it means and make it sound positive, but does it mean anything? Progression-free survival. An outcome driven by its effect on tumor shrinkage. So again, one for metastatic breast cancer. An outcome driven, but nonetheless a surrogate outcome, driven by its supposedly tumor shrinking ability. And then they get to call it something else as a result. So it could be past survival. Yeah, everybody's surviving. To the point they're surviving is a tumor shrinking. So Ralph D'Agostino, was a scientific advisor to the FDA at the time, wrote in a commentary in the New England Journal of Medicine that the FDA's acceptance of progression-free survival set a new precedent that could have serious consequences. The FDA subsequently withdrew approval after studies found that the drug did not increase overall survival,
and cause life-threatening harm. This is what I'm telling you about the GLP-1s. It does not, over the period of time you're taking it, it doesn't cure obesity, right? It doesn't. You can keep it down because you're starving for the rest of your life. But it's not a condition that you're now cured of and go on about your way, you know, healthy. Because we know that if you stop it, if you're no longer being malnourished, surprise, surprise, and your stomach, to the extent it even is able to recover eventually, starts to process at a regular rate, and now you get your cravings back because paralyzing the stomach or partially paralyzing or slowing it down might be somewhere in the biofeedback loop of whether or not you feel hungry. And so guess what? After you start feeling hungry again and your stomach starts processing again, you're going to gain weight back again. All right. So again, that one is probably found elsewhere, but it is called Should Regulatory Authorities Approve Drugs Based on Surrogate Endpoints, BMJ. And I'm not saying that's a British medical journal. I'm just throwing a guess at that. But 2021. And so then let's go back to the original Children's Health Defense coverage of the Lever article. Just for emphasis, we mentioned earlier that 9% of the, whatever it was, 240 or whatever that was, over a period of time, 10 years, give or take, and forgive me if I've got that number wrong, whatever that number was, you know, almost 10% met none of the foundational things. But we had mentioned that it was worse in for cancer, but just for emphasis, rather than just short of 1 out of 10, 1 in 4 of the cancer drugs did not meet any of the criteria. And there you go. It's because of tumor shrinkage rather than clinical outcomes such as reduced mortality or decreased symptoms. So this study is basically the, you know, if we don't learn from the past, we're fated to repeat it. This one mentioned in the childrenshealthdefense.org kind of overview of that Lever article. It's basically a repeat of the metastatic breast cancer treatment I told you about in the article that they, you know, that I already mentioned about the metastatic kind of to about, maybe it's the exact same one. Let me look again. No, that was not the same one. So this is another metastatic breast cancer treatment, and it's the approval in 2008 of the Avastin. AVASTIN to treat metastatic breast cancer. Now, that made net in just 2 years by 2010 and approved in 2008. In 2 years, it netted $6.8 billion. But eventually, because it's afterwards, so we're allowing these drugs to kill people. I'll follow up and repeat, but I'm just going to give you that up front. Eventually, 5 clinical trials. Just let it go to market, and then we'll guinea pig them. We'll just guinea pig them because we found, you know, a surrogate outcome. So $6.8 billion net in 2 years, or whatever, give or take, from sometime in 2008 to sometime in 2010. Eventually, 5 clinical studies failed to show any clinical improvements for patients on the drug. Instead, they showed the drug caused blood clots, perforated intestines. Do you understand the toxicity? How important is your waste management system? How important is the integrity of your waste management system, your intestines? Pretty important. The last thing you need is waste to be contaminating the rest of your body. That's what perforating them is starting to do and or is done. Stroke, heart problems, kidney malfunction. It's just a straight toxin. It doesn't matter the mechanism. And had they stuck to the four pillars, A, they wouldn't be profiteering because it would be slower. They'd
They'd pick drugs that had a better general profile. They'd eventually learn, well, that one's kind of the same general profile as this that we did a study on, and that general category seems to have side effects. Let's look for something else and not waste our time. So, yeah, the FDA eventually withdrew its approval in November 2011. But in the process, the agency and patients were attacked and harassed by the drug makers. And they're saying that the lever is, this is Children's Health Defense, saying the lever is saying the FDA has since been reluctant to withdraw approval of drugs. And here you go, under the general faster process from the late 80s, early 90s of the poison AZT, where, hey, well, you know, I mean, we'll get it on there and we'll do, you know, post-release trials. Yeah, accelerated pathway. They're supposed to conduct post-marketing trials to confirm. However, more than one-third of those approved drugs have never had such a trial. So this idea of more than one-third of the approved drugs have never had such a safety and effectiveness confirming trial post-release comes from a U.S. Department of Health and Human Service report called, well, Data Snapshot, Office of Inspector General, dated September 2022. Delays in confirmatory trials for drug applications granted FDA's accelerated approval raise concerns. So the background is, well, geez, you know, what's it say about our accelerated approval? And I'm going to find real quick how many were involved and exactly how they say, you know, whatever that was, a full third or whatever that number was, don't undergo that. That was more than one third of those approved drugs have never had such a trial, at least as of 2022. So I'm going to see if I can find that detail real quick. The high-level detail isn't a key takeaway on the very report. I might dig just a little bit more. But the high-level key takeaway says just what the other article said. They're not being dishonest. Children's Health Defense is pretty specific. More than one-third of accelerated approval drug applications with incomplete confirmatory trials are past their trial's original plan completion dates, including four that are more than 5 years past those dates. So if anything, Children's Health Defense was being generous because they said more than one-third don't have the confirmatory trials. No, a lot more than that don't. It's just that some of them are not yet past their planned completion dates. So one wonders, do we know that they're even in the works? So I'm going to look for that real quick. So the more details there is that this is accelerated approval pathway since 1992. 104 of all 278 have incomplete confirmatory trials. So the key takeaway was actually burying the lead. The key takeaway is not that it's they're past their date. It's that they're incomplete regardless. It's not like the key takeaway makes it sound like, well, some of them have hit. Never mind that argument. I'm not going to continue that argument. Instead, we'll go to a nice little bar chart. And you don't need to know the numbers, but it is crazy as far as the applications. You can look to 1996, and I don't know if this is total. Or just the two categories are by year since 1992, drug applications with complete trials, and drug applications drug applications with incomplete trials and drug applications with completed trials. What's very interesting is you see starting in 1992, there's no part of the stacked bar chart that is drug applications with incomplete trials, but they sneak in 1996. If this is single digits, I don't see anything to say it's otherwise, Then of about 10 in 1996, it looks like one or two have never been completed. Since 96, they've never completed their confirmatory. Similarly, then in 1998, the exact same amount. Down. No, not confirmed. In 04, so the big thing here is the trend has absolutely skyrocketed. So we went, you know, one or two not confirmed 96, one or two not confirmed 98. The trials that they're talking about that are candidates for this, so apparently those that are on the accelerated pathway, the numbers are kind of even in between 95 all the way through around 2012 or 2014 or 16. Both of those are around 10 a year in total. As I said then, from 92, it was even lower. Become 95-ish to about 2016, it was in the range of 7 to 12-ish to 10-ish that needed confirmatory trials. Of those then over that, as I said, 95 to 2016, so you're talking about 20, 21 years, you know, you've got a speckle in 96 that didn't complete their trials, which is still ridiculous. I mean, it's 30 years old almost. One or two in 1998, the same amount. None again that weren't confirmed and completed until 04, so a big 6-year difference. And then another 4 or 5 year gap in between the next time that there's a trial that's incomplete in 2009. And it, again, it looks like the one small amount, like one or two. So each of these instances looks like one or two based on the information here. And then 2010, nothing was not confirmed. 2011, 2012, 2014, like I said, those were all 10 or less in total, with one, or it looks like in 1 year there was two that's still not done. Then 2014, it rises and it's two not done off a little bit larger total. But it goes kind of to normal for another couple years. In 2016, it looks like it's probably 3 out of 10 where the trials are still not completed. And I know we're shorter, but again, you know, I know it's more recent. But what's interesting is the number that were eligible for confirmatory trials that got on the accelerated pathway from a 92 through, again, they don't have the numbers right above them, but from 92 through 2016, pretty steady. The high point was 2004. Wonder what's happening then. It looks to be about 14 to 16 maybe. And otherwise, the highs were just right around 10 or lower. And so you do realize that percentage-wise, it could be the more recent years. They haven't done their confirmatory, but they're supposed to be working with their sponsor on the timeline agreed to by FDA and the sponsor. So you do start to wonder, should they have finished by now? But come 2017, all of a sudden we're at 22. 2018, we're closer to, I'm guessing 22. It might be right near 20. 2018, we're 18 to 20. 2019, it goes down. 2020. Guys, all these, as I said, for about 25 years, were in the range of 10 or fewer, for the most part, with outside of one outlier. And then 2017 through 2019, it goes up a little. On average of those 3 years. 2020, it balloons. So 2017 through 2019, you know, the average there is probably about 17. We got a high of about 20 or 21, a low of about 12 or 13, and then a middle one of about 16. Average is about 17 after averaging under 10 for the last 25 years. And then in 2019, in total, we have something like 45 accelerated pathway drugs, and it looks like at least 90% and probably 95% from 2020 have not had their confirmatory trials completed to date. And of course, that's to the date of the study. And then 2021 is the last one they show here.
And that's almost entirely not confirmed as well, and that's 24-ish studies. So interesting how those accelerated pathway approvals have skyrocketed in the last handful of years. And this is what they say, one quarter of these approvals of the 278 occurred in 2020 and 2021. 70 of the 278. I think I might have said one third. I meant one quarter if I did. Yeah. On average, those that were completed took about 48 months. So, yeah, it's bad. Let me go back to the original one and see if there's anything else I want to say over there. This is interesting because it's more hidden. It's a sacred cow. They said the lever did create a database. A database? I'm not sure why I said that. I said it that way. I'm not a valley boy. So that's so totally true. You know, valley girls, you can hear them because if they're making a conclusive statement, but it ends up sounding like a question, that's a great way. That's a great way. That is, I am absolutely sure. Are you? Because it sounds like you're questioning yourself. The lever created a database that readers can search to determine how many of the four criteria drugs approved between 2013 and the end of 2022 meet. Although it does not include vaccine trials. He added that even clinical trials, this is a Children's Health Defense senior research scientist Carl Jablonowski, vaccine trials have similar variability in meeting the criteria. He added that even clinical trials that might claim to meet the criteria often do so, quote, in name only. This is going to be good. Oh, this is going to be good. You know, this is why you listen. For example, testing against placebos that are other vaccines or that include the adjuvant contained in the vaccine doesn't provide true safety data. Hello? Like, you're literally using as the placebo the toxic thing. So you're taking out the effect of the toxic thing. And if you don't believe me, I don't really care, but I'll explain anyway. I've told you before, for a while, I'm like, why would they put nanometals in vaccines? Why are adjuvants toxic metals? Because you have to give toxicity for enough for your body to generally understand this is a problem over here. And it has to first get the attention, call it the five-alarm fire effect. And then the immune system will go pay more attention to it and potentially create a specific antibody effect, which is what you're looking for. So again, Tyson told you, and now senior research scientist Carl Jablonowski will tell you, a placebo specifically does not have a medical effect except in vaccine research where the, quote, placebo may constitute all the excipients, components added as preservatives or to increase effectiveness, less the antigen. The excipients contain the chemicals or adjuvants that agitate the immune system and get it to pay attention to the antigen. I told you, brother. I didn't just read that either. That was off the top. The more alarming the adjuvant is to the immune system, the more likely it is to create durable immunity to the co-administered antigen. What I told you. Fire, you know, five alarm fire, the more alarming. But adjuvants are really just nasty chemicals and are by no means a healthy baseline. Exactly what I told you, man. Like, if you want to know what the placebo is, you give them saline. If you're giving them something else that is harmful, then you're not going to find a statistical significance if that's the trick. If the trick is, we know we've got some bad stuff in here, we're going to make the bad stuff the placebo, then your statistical significance for safety is going to be nowhere likely to be included. If you define the bad stuff, which you perfectly well know for the most part,
then you just define that as a placebo and you find safety every time because you referred to the placebo group as, instead of saline solution, the ones that got the harm without the active ingredient. It's like having an active ingredient, then looking at other ingredients on a food or something else and going, holy crap, this stuff's in there? Why is all that stuff in there? And you go, can't I just have the active ingredient that's supposed to be good for me? And then going, but in the trial, we're not going to tell you, well, I mean, it might be that in the trials, but certainly not in the press releases, they don't tell you, you know, what harmful additive they included in the placebo group, certainly not in the press releases. They would just stick to, oh, it was shown to be no less, not to have safety concerns versus a placebo group. And then Jablonowski goes to the idea of it's not even blinded. Even the BioNTech study didn't. We can't worry about blinding. The treatment is too important. The BioNTech study of the COVID-19 vaccine shows that the number of patients who withdrew from the study was 45% greater in the placebo group than in the vaccinated group. So statistically, 45% greater. Statistically, there is a 0.02 chance that the study was actually blinded, or 99.98 chance that it was unblinded. It was unblinded. Fauci was behind it. He unblinded HIV AZT studies too. Yeah, and so again, this is, like I said, it's like, okay, overall, and that's why you go to clinical outcomes. Overall, is it effective? Or do you just stop at, hey, we got the immune system to respond? Well, I should fucking hope you get the immune system to respond. Is it the right antibody for the actual thing? Because remember, mRNA, it's not even the right antibody for the actual thing because you didn't give the body the actual thing. You gave your body some silly-ass partial facsimile of the actual thing that you made the body create itself. So, yeah, it's going to produce antibodies. Is it the right antibody for when the thing comes in out from outside external biology? We don't know that. Many vaccines test for antibodies rather than for protection against disease. The more uncommon a disease is, the larger a trial must be to capture statistical significance. And again, this is just goes to the idea of the surrogate outcomes. It says other vaccines like Merck's HPV vaccine Gardasil, which the company touts as protecting women against cervical cancer, were never clinically tested against cancer outcomes because it takes such a long time for cancers to develop. Okay, that sounds stupid. I guess that means you need a longer study. There is no such thing as a prospective 30-year clinical trial. So the HPV vaccine was approved without establishing the primary clinical outcome. But it doesn't stop them from arguing it. Okay, so I'm going to go back to take away from that branch and see if one of the main articles have anything else I'd like to say. Even this is, because you're ignoring one of the foundations, this is a point that's even more interesting. Of those that had a post-market release, okay, you do need to do your confirmatory studies, even though it's after approval, after release. Even those that did complete those, well, if you're not matching one of the pillars, your confirmatory studies is really about the surrogate outcomes rather than the actual clinical outcomes. So they become just junk. Yeah. As this Brownstone Institute article says, the result is a regulatory system where the FDA no longer acts as a gatekeeper, but merely as a passive observer. And I guess I said this, but I almost feel like we missed this. I'm going to say it for emphasis. Remember that the vast majority of this shenaniganery
was in cancer, not the vast majority, but a higher percentage. It was much more likely to happen in the cancer industry. But I don't know if I said this. Of the 123 cancer drugs, the four, quote, minimum requirements, only three met all four of those. Only three. That'd be 3% if there were only 100 cancer drugs. We're at 123, so it's more like 4/5 of three. Right? So 2.4%, something like that. Yeah, and like I said, it's because the endpoint was tumor shrinkage, regardless of whether or not it improves survival or quality of life. And here they have another one, Copiktra, C-O-P-I-K-T-R-A, approved in 2018 for blood cancers. The FDA gave it a green light based on improved, quote, progression-free survival, which again is how long does a tumor stay stable? That's where they're getting it. Does the tumor not increase? Not whether it goes back, not whether you don't have cancer anymore, but, oh, no, it treats cancer. I mean, yeah, if I wash my hands, it treats bug bites. A little. It helps, but it definitely doesn't get away, you know, make the bug bites go away. But a review of post-marketing data showed that patients taking Copiktra died 11 months earlier than those on even a comparator drug. Goodness gracious. And then it took 6 years after those studies showed the drug reduced patient survival for the FDA to warn the public that Copiktra should not be used as a first or second line treatment, citing an increased risk. Now, notice they didn't say, just take it off. Elmiron, interstitial cystitis. Hopefully I'm saying that right. A painful bladder condition. Approved in 1996. Somebody said the FDA authorized it on, quote, close to zero data. Maybe it's the main article we're reporting on. But that's as long as the company conducts a follow-up study to determine whether it actually worked. They authorized it based on close to zero data for interstitial cystitis, which is a painful bladder condition. But you need a follow-up study. Wasn't completed for 18 years. And when it was, it showed Omiron was no better than placebo. In the meantime, hundreds of patients suffered vision loss or blindness. Others were hospitalized with colitis. Some died. Yet Elmiron is still on the market today. Anyway, there's more. The Brownstone article goes into even more information. Give you a couple of headers instead of going down unless something really catches my eye. Dangling approvals and regulatory paralysis. The FDA even has a term, dangling approvals, for drugs that remain on the market despite failed or missing follow-up trials. Billions wasted, thousands harmed. Between 2018 and 2021, through Medicare and Medicaid, U.S. taxpayers paid $18 billion for drugs approved under the condition that follow-up studies would be conducted. Many never were. Even though the approved studies, remember only because I was wondering, I said, well, maybe some of them wouldn't be approved yet. Well, last one they looked at was something like 2021, 2022 in that bar chart I talked about. And remember, then later they said, hey, on the average is about 48 months. So that's 2 years, which means most of them should have come in by now. But many never were, studies never were conducted. A 2015 study, let's see if I can see the name of that one. You can look it up. You'll find the brownstone.org article on this. 2015 study found that 86% of cancer drugs approved between 2008 and 2012, based on surrogate outcomes, showed no evidence that they helped the patient live any longer.
And again, Sergeant, was it, did you have a nicer time while you were dying? I don't mean to be that crude, that came off wrong, but that, I'm just making the exaggeration. So I'm still dying. Well, isn't that just kind of, you know, aren't you now then to just kind of opium? And there's another drug that's used normally. I'm just not a drug guy, so sometimes I forget these details. Or morphine. We're just giving morphine for pain? If that, oh, well, I mean, you're not surviving anymore. In fact, you're surviving less, but maybe we can make your suffering less. Isn't that, you know, what such an inelegant solution or non-specific solution such as morphine is for? So I'm going to say again, 2015 study found that 86% of cancer drugs approved between 2008 and 2012 based on surrogate outcomes showed no evidence that they help patients live longer. And while I'm not going to go to it, I can tell that it's JAMA, Journal of the American Medical Association. An estimated 128,000 Americans die each year from the effects of properly prescribed medications, excluding opioid overdoses, which is more than all deaths from illegal drugs combined. 2024 analysis by Danish physician Peter Goetsch, I don't know how to say his name, found that adverse events from prescription medicines now rank among the top three causes of death globally. Next headline, we're not going to go into it. Doctors misled by the drug labels. Yeah, I am going to go into it slightly. 2016 survey published in JAMA, asked practicing physicians a simple question. What does FDA approval actually mean? Only 6% got it right. Who is the FDA working for is another header of this article, which is interesting. Another header of this article? No, that's it. So there you go. Brownstone.org. Or if you want to go back to the Substack where it is, this person got permission to republish it from the Substack, apparently. And that Substack is blog.mariannedemassey.com. But yeah, this one's off Brownstone Institute. And I think that's the last I need to go through. Let me see if any of these others are just interesting additions. This is one that was in Science Daily, June 22nd, 2025. So brand new. Basically, you know, not a month old yet. FDA under fire, data discrepancies uncovered in AstraZeneca approval trials. Investigations find evidence of serious misreporting, raising fresh doubts over the approval and decades-long use of Ticagrelor, T-I-C-A-G-R-E-L-O-R. So let me see if I have a takeaway. Summary, fresh concerns, blah, 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 have emerged about the platelet studies underpinning the approval of AstraZeneca's multi-billion dollar heart drug. A new BMJ investigation reveals data discrepancies, missing lab readings, and questions about the integrity of the trial process. Notably, key results reported in a major cardiology journal were inaccurately presented, and some study contributors were omitted or denied involvement. With generics on the horizon, critics say these revelations highlight potential dangers, including severe rebound effect and bleeding risks that were never properly closed. I'd like to think that approaching our 6 months of Make America Healthy Again, that some of the people are like, I can't believe I can't talk about this, are more likely to talk about this, and it snowballs a bit. So that's one of them. It goes into the Fuller situation, the BMJ uncovering fresh concerns. And then let me see what this other one was. integrity concerns, that's actually the same thing. It's around the ticagrelor. I'll add this key takeaways here. Let me see if it has more key takeaways. You can hide some of the key takeaways. Inaccuracies in that drug's foundational studies have raised concerns about its perceived benefits and FDA approval process. Safety concerns include potential rebound thrombotic events, which would be, it's a blood clot issue due to ticagrelor's reversible binding and overstated platelet inhibition. Pharmacists should monitor patients closely, counsel on adherence, and discuss alternative antiplatelet agents with prescribers. As generics become available, pharmacists should reassure patients about bioequivalence while addressing concerns about trial data integrity. So there's that one. Then we were... Oh, yeah, yeah. How about this one? It's probably something we semi-covered. It is, but July 2nd, 2025. So this might go to, hey, you know, maybe people are feeling better about how we get back. Why don't we get back to regular science? It might have come from a conference, but I'm not sure. It's an article, it looks like, as opposed to a journal. I can't tell if a journal article or an article. Post-hoc analysis highlights brexpiprazole's efficacy and tolerability in Alzheimer agitation. So that's a, can we recover this mess? You know, after it got dissed for being so bad. So that's what that is. So we won't cover that, but you can look it up if you want. And then, yeah, I think we covered all the other ones. The two lever articles, we'll repeat the lever article. It says you can get a free account or log in. I'm just not doing it because I'm recording. And maybe you can read both of these. Here's an interesting thing off of maybe part two, FDA approved and ineffective. And yes, it is the same authors as that one journal article I told you about. Jeanne, J-E-A-N-N-E, Lenzer, and Shannon Brownlee, ending in L-E-E. This is interesting. When I tell you, they just throw shit out there and don't care because they look at these side surrogate outcomes. They have a story early about, wait a second, I have never seen this eye problem. We have to come up with a new name for it. Odd patches of pigment on a woman's retina, and it is something that the retinal specialist and surgeon at Emory University in Georgia had not seen, did not fit with any known diagnosis. Wait a second, he says. Maybe not as bad, but maybe I did see patients or patient records recently with at least a similar finding, even if not as bad. He dug up five more patients at Emory with the same retinal changes. Oh, we're going blind. I'll happen to be taking Elmiron, a drug for bladder condition called interstitial cystitis. So this probably goes to that same one, but just covering the blindness aspect. So when I say they're inelegant and they just find something and they don't care what else it does, if you're, all you're looking for is the surrogate outcome related to the thing you want to treat, then you're ignoring all the other surrogate outcomes. You're not worried about long-term adverse events. You know, you say, hey, it's not as painful. And the surrogate outcome for interstitial cystitis might just be that. I believe that said it was a painful bladder condition, but I'm not 100% sure. So you just go, hey, it's not as painful. That's it being not as painful is associated with it getting better. So we'll just use that as our surrogate outcome as opposed to a clinical outcome. And so they published their findings with a new cause of blindness, dubbing it pigmentary maculopathy. But wait a second. they're calling it almost like it's a disease when it's really a side effect of from a toxic drug. They'd never seen it before, and literally all of the ones they found it for were taking Elmiron. And they then describe a condition instead of defining it as, if you take Elmiron, you could go blind. And that's the lead, not the new name. Oh, my lordy. So, yeah, check out that one at the lever and see more of that. But again, FDA approved and ineffective. I believe that was part two. And then the lever, part one, is the deadly secrets behind, quote, breakthrough Alzheimer drugs. Regulators approve controversial therapies amid excess deaths, questionable efficacy, and conflicts of interest. Okay, guys, thanks for listening to the Scales of Truth. I'm Tyson Harley.